Well, I'm Richard Bramhall. I'm the company secretary of the low-level radiation campaign, which is something Chris Busby and I set up in 1993. At that time, within the Green Party, but we very rapidly went independent of all party politics. And we have been campaigning on the health effects of radioactive releases to the environment, which is something that the industry has been lying about for 80 years. And we very rapidly ran a very successful campaign to stop a huge relaxation emanating from Europe in the shape of a European directive, which would have allowed a huge relaxation in the levels of radioactivity in materials which could be released from nuclear installations and regulation to be reused in any capacity. So you might have found that bits of a nuclear reactor were turning up in your baked bean cans. We put a stop to that with the help of Michael Meacher, the late Michael Meacher, who was at that time the Environment Minister. And he set up a committee called the Committee on Health Effects of Radioactivity in the Environment, which reported in 2004. And since then, we have just gone on producing more evidence that permitted releases of radioactivity to the environment are much more dangerous than had previously been thought.
Well, okay, Richard, but what are your qualifications to do this?
None, except, I suppose, a certain amount of native intelligence. I never went to university. When I was in my teens, I wanted to be a double bass player. So the best place to learn to do that was in the Royal College of Music, which I attended in the 1960s. And as soon as I left college, I went to a job in the Royal Opera House at Covent Garden, and then stood that for about 3 years without going completely bonkers, working underground. And went on to the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. But eventually I dropped out and moved to a small holding in Wales. And it was in Wales that I met Chris Busby. And he showed me some early results of his research, because I was at that time the press officer for Wales Green Party. And he said, "What do you think of this?" And this was a graph which showed the variations in fallout from nuclear weapons testing in the 1950s and 60s. And against that, he had plotted the incidence of infant mortality in Wales. And the two curves were exactly the same. And I just found that intuitively very, very disturbing and very exciting. And really, I've been running on that kind of inspiration ever since.
Yeah, but the nuclear industry, Richard, tells us that it spends something like a quarter of the money that it spends on safety, possibly even more, because so much goes into designing these, particularly nuclear power stations, so that they are totally safe and that no radiation leaks out.
Well, that's actually, if they tell you that, that is a lie. Every nuclear power station on the planet releases particulate matter, tiny particles of radioactive material. The United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Radiation in the Environment, no, I've got that name wrong, it's UNSCEAR, United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, that's the acronym. Used to publish data on the amount of particulates emitted to the environment, and the data, it's on the internet. You can find it. Rather complicated, but it's not too difficult to work out that every operating nuclear power station on the planet emits enormous quantities of radioactive particles, and these will all be smaller than 5 microns, that is, smaller than 5 millionths of a meter in diameter, because the filters are designed to capture anything bigger than that. But those which are smaller, they emit to the atmosphere, where we can all breathe them in, and we have to. because we have no choice. And that is in addition to the fallout from accidents like Fukushima and Chernobyl, and from the nuclear weapons tests in the 1950s and 60s, which are still in the environment. I mean, these particles are virtually indestructible, and they do get circulated around, and so there is no doubt that we are inhaling those. And the great lie that the nuclear industry and its regulators spread is that the doses from those particles are too small to do us any harm. Well, Busby's research shows that that is not true.
I noticed that one of the reports you produced, you sent me, and I had a brief read through it. This is fairly recent, actually, a summary and a brief explanation of the origins, history, and current dialogue concerning evidence that there are grounds for an urgent re-evaluation of the link between ionizing radiation and health problems. So I suppose the first question to ask before we even really get into that report is, what exactly are these particulates? What radioactive substances are coming out? Is this uranium? What is it that's coming out of these power stations and then settling on the ground or being blown through the air?
Uranium, you were right. Particularly, it's in the form of uranium oxide. Relatively insoluble, very long-lived. And this is the UNSCEAR data, which I cited, doesn't actually quantify whether it is uranium, but it does have to be uranium. Nuclear reactors are fundamentally composed of uranium. The Chernobyl reactor had 200 or even 220 tons of uranium inside it when it blew up, and that burned for 10 days. So that those clouds which we see in the photographs of the burning reactor were composed principally of uranium particles. Nuclear weapons are fundamentally made of uranium, and that stuff is shattered into the tiniest of fragments in the nuclear explosion, and then those particles travel all the way around the world. This is beyond dispute. What is to be disputed is the fact that the environment agencies, and there are four in the United Kingdom, have no data whatever on the presence of those types of uranium particles in the environment. Nobody collects data on that. The only people looking for those kinds of pollutants are us. It's not particularly easy to find them, but it can be done with pretty much kitchen sink technology. Within the report which you're citing, Tony, there is a photograph which we developed. Busby and I produced this photograph. It's made with the dust that was shaken from a car engine's air filter, which we obtained from near the Hinkley Point reactors. Busby opened it up and shook out a small portion of the dust, smeared it across a piece of plastic. It's a special kind of plastic called CR39, which is known to be sensitive to the alpha rays which come from particles, or come from plutonium or americium or uranium. And when you develop those and put them under a microscope, which Busby did to produce the photograph in that report, you can see that there are myriad tiny pits in the surface of the plastic. Now, every one of those pits represents the impact of a single alpha ray coming from the particle. And the terrifying thing about this image is that we know that you can easily inhale those particles. And once that particle is embedded in body tissue, in particular it's going to be in the lymph nodes, then is irradiating the surrounding tissues, the surrounding body cells with their sensitive DNA, in exactly the same way as the plastic is irradiated and damaged in the image that you can see.
But what about the health effects? What evidence is there about this? Because, I understand the nuclear industry, and I think this is probably true ever since the Windscale fire in the late 1950s, which was a similar, I suppose, a similar thing to Chernobyl, really, where you've got quite a long fire going on within the reactor space, which is spewing out particles, radioactive particles, up the chimney or out into the environment. But I mean, where is and what is the evidence that this is damaging to humans?
It's not too hard to find. One very telling piece of evidence is a review by colleagues of ours, Professor Inge Spitz Feuerhaker and Professor Sebastian Flugweil, working with Busby, produced a report. They looked at the official cancer registry, registries in Russia and the ex-Russian member states. Each city has its own cancer registry, and it's not cancer registries. These are registries of congenital malformations in newborns. The Russians have always been quite good at recording such data. And what you can see in those reports is that there is a massive increase in the rate of congenital malformations in the year and the second year after the Chernobyl accident. And that defines a huge error in the officially recognized risk factors for the radiation from uranium. And what we're saying is that that incidence of very high rates of congenital malformation is a sign that the risk factors which the pro-nuclear authorities are using are very, very seriously out of kilter. And as another piece of evidence of this nature is a study which Busby re-analyzed. It's data which was produced by British authorities looking at the health effects of high tension power lines. Because that's another type of health threat which has possibly been underestimated, and it was possible to reanalyze the data and show that the power lines, which are known to concentrate the electrical charge on particles, are causing high rates of leukemia among children living within half a mile downwind.
Right. So, whereabouts, why is it that we're only hearing this from Chris Busby? This is peculiar because we've got lots of scientists around the world, lots of scientists in Britain. Why is it really almost all this evidence coming from Chris?
Because it's a topic he has made very specially his own. And he also happens to have that a particular mental attitude which looks behind the conclusions which conventional epidemiologists draw from their own data. An example of this is an attempt by the Americans to show that nothing happened to the crew of the United States aircraft carrier, the Reagan. Ronald Reagan had been, when the Fukushima accident happened, Ronald Reagan happened to be in the vicinity of Japan and actually sailed through the cloud of fallout which was belching out of the wrecked reactors at Fukushima. And there was quite a fuss because of a surprisingly large number of the sailors on the US Reagan got cancer. And in order to attempt to deny that the radioactivity they'd been exposed, I mean, it was so much radioactivity falling on the decks of that ship that they had to go out with hoses and hose the damn thing down. But subsequently, in an attempt to deny that the cancers were being caused by the fallout to which those sailors were exposed, The United States government commissioned a study in which they compared the rates of cancer in the crew of the Reagan with the crews of a number of other nuclear-powered ships of the same class, which had also been active, but not in the that hadn't been close enough to Fukushima to be exposed to the cloud, the fallout cloud. Now, I'm just telling you this story to illustrate the way that Busby will look at the data and reinterpret it in a way that is very revealing.
Yeah, well,
you haven't come to the best bit yet. When he looked at the figures for cancer in the crews of the whole nuclear fleet, he showed that they were 9.4 times as likely to be suffering from cancer as the population of the United States in general, which was a valid control population because the crews of the ships were American and they were matched to the same age group of the Americans who had not gone to sea. So that's a valid control. And a 9.4 or 9.2 fold excess of cancer in the sailors is quite unexpected because these were fit young men, they had jobs, whereas the people who were in the population generally of the United States were, some of them were unemployed, they might have been unfit. So you would expect the cancer in the sailors to be lower than the cancer in the population in general. So when you find that it's actually 9.2 more prevalent in the sailors, the conclusion to be drawn is that working on nuclear power ships isn't very good for you, because essentially a nuclear powered ship is a steel box with a nuclear reactor in the middle of it, not very well shielded, because you can't have the massive shielding that a nuclear power station has. These people are inhaling little particles of uranium oxide as they go about their business. And that is the very likely explanation for that quite amazing finding.
Amazing. And also, I suppose this typifies the reaction of military governments and the nuclear industry to these sorts of incidents, that they do everything they possibly can to cover them up. Of course, I mean, that they would say that the low-level radiation campaign that you represent, that the levels of radiation that you're looking at are too low to cause any worry or concern to the public. But if you look at, for example, I mentioned the Windscale fire. I like to call it the Sellafield fire because, of course, they changed the name because it had got such a bad name after the 1957 fire. It happened at a time where the British government under Macmillan was doing some sort of a very important negotiation with the United States over the sharing of nuclear technology. And so the very first disaster we had here in Britain was shrouded with secrecy and absolutely stamped on as a cover-up. You know, there were all sorts of lies told about, what had happened or hadn't happened, because they didn't want to worry the Americans and get them to say, oh, well, we can't be partners with the British because they don't know what they're doing with nuclear power. And of course, you know, in the background to all of this is the nuclear weapons industry, which really seems to be driving much of this. So the power, I suppose, involved the secrecy and the money. It's a bit of a toxic mix. Can you just take us through attempts that the government have made over the years to set up various groups, committees, get laws enforced to make sure that nuclear power is safe? And also, if you can take us through to today, where we are and how safe and how good the government regulation is.
Well, the pinnacle of that kind of cover-up attempt is to be seen in the history of COMARE, which is the British government's advisory committee. The COMARE stands for Committee on Medical Aspects of Radiation in the Environment. And that committee was set up as a result of a Yorkshire Television documentary, Windscale, the Nuclear Laundry, which was broadcast in 1983, if memory serves, well, that Thatcher was the Prime Minister at the time, within days of the broadcast of that YTV programme, Thatcher had called in Professor Douglas, Sir Douglas Black, and he set up very quickly set up a committee, and one of its recommendations that there should be an independent committee, which turned out to be Kumari. That was established very, very swiftly. Now, the first chair of Kumari was Professor Martin Bobrow. And the first two reports in the 1980s, both of them, were looking very intently at the health effects of particulates. And those are quite revealing. They certainly indicate that Bobrow and his colleagues were not convinced that the particles weren't a problem. And this was at a time, if you remember, when Yorkshire Television had broadcast a programme which showed enormously high values of radioactive dust in people's houses along the coast of off Sellafield, close to Sellafield. And Bobrow was looking very carefully at that type of contamination. And then after the second report, which was 1988, there was a long delay. And Bobrow disappeared as the chair of Kumari and was replaced by somebody whose name will come to me in a moment. And after that, from the third report up till the 17th, which is their most recent, though it was published 6 years ago, nearly 7 years ago now, the 17th report. From that time, Professor Bryn Bridges was the replacement chair. From that time, the emphasis of Kumari's interests shifted away from particulates. The third report just about mentioned uranium particulates. After that, if you look at any of those reports, you can get them all off the internet and do word searches. If you search for uranium, I don't believe you'd find any mention of uranium. Nothing significant from the fourth to the 17th report. So they've turned the searchlight away from particles. And the reason for that is that they know perfectly well that what we're saying is right, that the uranium particles, once inhaled, and they go straight through the lung wall and into any part of the body where they can get to, it's to be carried through the blood and the lymphatic circulation systems, and they will lodge anywhere. They know perfectly well that what we're saying is right, that the health effects of that type of contamination of the human body has massively higher genetic effects than you would expect on the basis of dose alone. When it comes to uranium particles, the concept of dose is completely useless. It's like saying, well, you can let a gunman into a football stadium and let him fire off his gun if he really feels like it, because the dose from his bullets will be shared among all the people in the crowd. It's complete nonsense. Nearly everybody will be missed. The people that are not missed will be very severely hurt or killed. And it's just the same with alpha particles in body tissue coming off these tiny scraps of uranium and plutonium. It's not the average dose that counts. It's the local wreckage that is caused by these very high energy and very short-ranged alpha particles.
Is there any way that people can sort of, I mean, other than moving away from a nuclear power station, is there any way people can avoid this, or potentially, you know, I don't know, eat certain foods that will help their body remove these kinds of toxins?
I don't think so. Best to move away from places like Hinkley Point, move away from Sellafield. Don't live in a place where the chimney stacks of an active nuclear power station are being blown towards you. Just be just be cautious. It's a good idea not to inhale the sea spray from a place like, in a place like, well, almost anywhere around the Severn Estuary. I wouldn't go there, because we know that there's a lot of radioactivity in the environment. There's been nuclear power stations at Hinkley Point, at Barclay, at one of the other sites. There's been Amersham International pumping radioactivity into the environment, straight into the sea there. There's the River Wye and the Severn draining the Welsh uplands, where the fallout from Chernobyl and the West and the weapons tests in the 1950s and 60s is still washing down uranium particles. And there's a lot of that stuff in the mud of the Severn Estuary. And when that mud is washed towards the shore and is thrown up by the action of waves and the bubbles in the surf breaking and throwing little tiny particles in the into the air, you can see this stuff if you look across the white, the breakers, and see there's a pale mist across the surface of the water. And if the wind is blowing on the shore, then it is blowing those particles inland. Mm. Harwell used to research this kind of thing in the 1980s, but they stopped when they realized that those part they were seeing in their filters, which they deployed up to 9.2 miles inland, there was a continuous trend in the amount of plutonium, and you can bet uranium, on those filters. And that stuff is blowing inland. Well, I live 40 miles from the sea. I live 70 miles away from the Severn Estuary. And that's about as close as I would want to be. You can choose where you want to live to minimise your exposure to this kind of stuff.
I mean, with your connections with the Green Party, I'd be interested to know what your, I don't know if you still are, but what your thoughts are about the future of nuclear, because there seems to be a veering towards particularly environmentalists saying, well, actually, due to the fact that it's not burning fossil fuels, nuclear could be an important part of the solution to the energy crisis.
Well, I no longer have any connection with the Green Party. I left in 1997, I should think. I'm completely non-aligned politically. I'm not a member or a supporter of any political party. I'm opposed to some of them, but I won't. We don't need to go into detail on that. Sorry, I've lost the track of the second part of your question.
I mean, do you think that
The alternatives and the greenwashing?
I suppose particularly post Fukushima.
We have to think in terms of the real renewables. Nuclear energy is not a renewable, and it is not low carbon. We're constantly seeing the supporters of nuclear power these days saying, oh, it's only 6 grams per kilowatt hour of carbon. That is just not true. Nuclear may be quite low in carbon output during its generating phase, but you have to consider the whole cradle-to-grave life cycle of nuclear power, starting with mining the uranium, and then processing it, and all the transport and all the building of the nuclear power station which is a very, very massive engineering project. Then you get into the generating phase, and then you have to store the fuel, you have to reprocess the fuel and store the outputs for thousands and thousands of years. So the whole life cycle is massively polluting. And Martin Soverkool, Science Policy Research Unit at the University of Sussex, has done a quite thorough review of the carbon footprint of nuclear power, and he's analysed that and announced that the output of electricity from nuclear power costs 66 grams of carbon per kilowatt hour. Now that puts it a third the third most polluting means of making electricity after coal and gas. So the continual repetition of the idea that carbon is that nuclear is low carbon is just not true. The people who are saying it, and no doubt some of them sincerely believe it, they are misspeaking because they're only considering the carbon output during the generating phase and ignoring all the construction, the mining, the construction, and the very, very long afterlife of the nuclear output, where you have to look after the radioactive materials in perpetuity.
Could you just remind us of the name of this professor or doctor at Sussex University that's produced this?
Benjamin Sovacool. It's not particularly recent. The paper that I frequently cite is from 2008.
And where's the best place if people want to follow the low-level radiation campaign? How can they follow you?
The low-level radiation campaign website. There's a lot of good material on it, but it's far from complete. It's one of my great regrets that I lack the manpower and the hours in the week to do it. It's llrc.org.
There's still some fairly recent stuff up on here from 2020, etc. If listeners are interested in following it, it's LLRC, Low Level Radiation Campaign, abbreviated.org, /children.htm will take you straight to this fascinating report commissioned by Children with Cancer UK. You know, this is very important information. And I suppose, you know, it's like so many things. It's the effect on children who are unwitting parents, a mass media that's not telling anybody, which is one of the most horrifying things about low-level nuclear radiation. Do you think that, you know, there's any prospect of getting some changes in regulation to make it, you know, literally impossible to be putting more of this radiation out into the environment in Britain?
Yes, I think that the length to which the government goes in this country to silence me indicate that they are very, very scared.